The impeachment of a president for the third time in history. Where did Texas lawmakers come down? The lowdown on how it all went down today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. In November, a bond proposition failed in Midland, but wait, there's more. Suddenly, a box of votes turns up, and what do you know? It changes the outcome. Old-style Texas election shenanigans or something else? Social media monitoring. Are workers the ones paying the price? Also, Texas Monthly issues this year's Bum Steer Award, and there's a tie for first place. Or is it last place? All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this day after what by any standard was an historic one for the United States, a day in which only for the third time since the founding of the Republic has an American president been impeached. This is, of course, not Capitol Hill's final answer on Donald Trump. To be kicked out of office, he would have to be found guilty in the Senate by two-thirds of that body, or 67 senators. And with Republicans in control and apparently willing to back Mr. Trump's innocence claim, the betting line is pretty lopsided against the president having to move out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue sometime before next January at the earliest. However, there is more than presidential politics at play here, because how one votes on this matter is history itself, right? One that Texas voters may reference come November, and there are lots of political contests down ballot, too, let's not forget. So the stakes could be rather high here. Watching the drama unfold in the House chamber yesterday was Abby Livingston, Washington Bureau Chief for the Texas Tribune. Abby, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Thanks for having me.
I guess it's fair to say things played out rather as expected yesterday, votes along party lines, whether or not to impeach President Trump. What about the Texas delegation?
It went straight down the party line. Everybody kind of went with their team. And so you could feel it in the room. There were a couple of crossovers. I don't think significant enough, and they weren't Texans. But generally speaking, you know, at times in the room, I don't like sports metaphors, but I'll use one on the Standard. It sometimes felt like being at the Texas OU game in the Cotton Bowl. There was a line down the middle, and these people did not like each other.
Yeah, the other side could do no right, and their side could do no wrong. I totally understand the metaphor that you're drawing there. But it did seem at times that emotions were running pretty high. Let's hear Texas Republican Louie Gohmert from Tyler in a full-throated reply to the Democrats.
The impeachment serves two purposes. Number one, stop the investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice and Ukraine into the corruption of Ukraine interference into the U.S. Election in 2016. You said,
well, one of the things he injected this conspiracy theory that Ukraine played a role in 2016 to support Hillary Clinton, and a number of senior intelligence officials have pushed back against that, including Trump administration officials. But what was amazing about that exchange was right after he said that, the House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler of New York interjected and said he regretted that a member of the House would, I think his word was, spout Russian propaganda on the House floor. And this is one of those reasons why it's important for a reporter to go to an event and not just watch it on television. So Gohmert came back to the podium and the mic was cut off, which I didn't even realize because I can't tell the difference when there's a mic or not when I'm in the room. And he continued shouting and then he walked away and we thought it was over. And then suddenly, next thing I know, I looked up and Louie Gohmert was in Chairman Nadler's face. He walked over to the Democratic side and he was gesticulating and he had his finger in his face pointing at him, but we have no idea what he said.
So this was bigger than about that phone call, in a sense. What seemed to upset some Democrats was that Louie Gohmert would come out there on the floor of the House and start talking about this conspiracy theory, which has been debunked in many media circles, that Ukraine was involved in some kind of manipulation of the 2016 presidential election here in the U.S., right?
Yes. And to be clear, Republicans took issue with many things Democrats said. So I don't want it to seem like it was all one-sided of Democrats being unhappy with Republican rhetoric. This was just the most physically dramatic that I really don't recall seeing anything like that on the House floor in a long, long time.
There were a lot of Democrats who wished that perhaps Republicans were not as loyal to their party, at least as they saw it. But I'm curious, where does this leave, first of all, the House and second, the Senate, when it comes to moving forward, not just with impeachment, but with matters of state that still have to be handled?
That is a question I was mulling in the room, and I had a feeling in there that this might be like the confirmation hearings for Justice Kavanaugh. It kind of felt like we're moving in a new direction of the Republican Party and Democratic Party really not liking each other. I am not sure how they come back from this. For years, Republicans and Democrats will tout, hey, I've got this special friend on the other side of the aisle. Look at how great I am. I'm bipartisan. Even if we don't agree on policy, we can find common ground. And the air in the room was mutual disgust. And I'm not really sure how the House rebuilds from that.
Abby Livingston, Washington Bureau Chief of the Texas Tribune. Abby, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So Election Day was more than 6 weeks ago, right? But Midlanders still aren't sure if a $500 million school bond won voters' approval or not. Through a series of missteps, the results have flipped back and forth, pass, then fail, then pass again. The confusions led to considerable doubt in the community's ability to run elections, of special concern with a big one less than a year away. So what exactly happened in Midland? Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden breaks it all down for us.
It started with a controversial $569 million bond initiative that would build two new high schools for the overcrowded Midland Independent School District. The arguments for or against it, that's a whole other story. Just know emotions on either side were already running high when this happened.
Now for election 2019 coverage. We're going to begin with the shocker of last night. You've heard that every vote counts. Well, that could not be more true in Midland County, where literally a handful of votes made all the difference.
The bond measure looked like it had passed by 12 votes. And for a week, that's what everyone thought, until someone noticed an error in vote totals posted by the Midland County Elections Office. Turns out, mail-in ballots hadn't been included in the final tally. And when elections officials added them in, the bond package had failed by 25 votes. Bond advocates called for a recount, so 10 days later, volunteers gathered at the community's county annex to recount ballots. Dave Joyner was there and says it all took until 4 in the morning, when finally...
That's it. There's no more ballots. And so the results are done. Like, the fact is, the bond passed.
Joyner is part of We Choose Our Future, the political action committee that advocated for the bond. He says moments after the recount results were in, when everyone looked closer, they realized there was another big problem.
Well, how could this be off by 820-something votes?
Hundreds of ballots had disappeared.
Are you sure that there aren't 800 votes somewhere? Are we missing a box?
It was wild when they came and said, well, apparently we have a discrepancy of 820 votes. What? After all this? What?
Deborah Lane was stunned. She's been Midland County's elections administrator for the last 5 years. And throughout this whole process, Lane's maintained that she and her staff haven't done anything wrong.
You know, I have worked very hard in this community. I believe in the elections. And for this to have gone as horribly awry as it has, it hurts me.
But mistakes were made, like releasing the wrong election results that took over a week to correct. Midland County also used new voting machines for the November 5th election that Land admits her staff needed more training on how to operate.
This election process has been so miserable from just about every aspect that you can think of.
Brandon Hodges has little sympathy for Land. He's the head of the political action committee, Better Bond for Midland, which opposed the bond package.
She should be able to reconcile the votes. It is her job.
Hodges' irritation was on full display at a public meeting last Thursday, where volunteers were counting up the paper ballots. Pro and anti-bond advocates, Midland ISD personnel, and county officials got together to try to figure out just what had happened. Was there something wrong with the voting machines? Had the recount results been way off? And then a county staff member said they found something, a ballot box.
How did they just find a ballot box? They just said, we walked in and we found it? Like,
you see how I'm sweating, Mitch? I can't answer it, dude, because no one knows. I mean, that's, I don't know.
The box had been sitting in the Midland County Elections Office uncounted for weeks. There was no documentation of it anywhere. Worse yet, Deborah Lane had been insisting that all of the ballot boxes were accounted for. Officials would later crack it open and find the 800-plus missing ballots, further confusing the bond vote's final outcome.
Mistakes are going to be made. You know, I can only say I'm sorry so many times. I wish it hadn't happened. Believe me, I wish it hadn't happened.
On Friday, Midland's Election Committee is set to discuss Land's performance as the county's election administrator, which could lead to her being fired or suspended. For her part, Land says this has been a learning experience, and that changes will be made to election procedures and training in the future. As for the bond, it still is technically passed after the official recount. The only way to include the found 800 votes, which could possibly fail the bond, is for the election to be contested in court. Both supporters and opponents of the bond say they're putting lawsuits together.
We have to file a contest, and we are going to file a contest.
Brandon Hodges and everyone else who's challenging the results believe that's the only way voters will get a fair end to this election. For the Texas Standard, I'm Mitch Borden.
Time to check in with Wells Dunbar, our social media editor. What are you seeing out there in social media land?
Hi, David. Well, a range of impeachment reactions pouring in on the Texas Standard Facebook page. No surprise after yesterday's historic impeachment vote. Charlie Alberson says, what does it really matter when the Senate is full of good old boys who aren't going to do anything about it? He says the fix is in and impeachment changes nothing. Kim Munson disagrees. She cites the importance to have this vote on record and adds the law requires a remedy like impeachment. Lawrence Strack points to reactions offshore, citing a quote from Vladimir Putin going around saying Trump was impeached for spurious reasons. That's all you need to know, Lawrence says. Craig Andrews York says, it's a start. It's going to be interesting to see how Nancy Pelosi maneuvers against Mitch McConnell in the Senate and how the incumbents and the GOP react over the next 11 months until Election Day. However, David Ortiz notes that his support for the president just went up. Yes, we're happy on Team Trump. Trust me, he says. Obviously, no shortage of opinions out there following yesterday's vote. I'll be back with more reactions from social media later in the broadcast.
Well, you know, I'm guessing there might be a kind of shortage in the sense that we haven't heard from you yet, right? So you need to tweet us at Texas Standard or just join the social media platform of your choice and let us know what you think about the impeachment situation or anything else making news in your neighborhood.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Business and your money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. Like DQ's used to, Main Street small town Texas is distinguished by its dollar stores, right? You know the shops I'm talking about. Small discount stores that sell a variety of household goods and a small selection of food. The two largest chains, Dollar General and Dollar Tree, have about 30,000 stores in all, more locations than McDonald's and Walmart combined, truth be known. But it's not just rural Texas that's seen the boom. You may have noticed in big cities, these stores tend to sprout up and cluster in lower income communities. And now some of those cities are pushing back, like one in North Texas. The Standard's own Alexandra Hart has more.
Earlier this year, Fort Worth councilperson Kelly Allen Gray noticed something unusual in her district. A lot of dollar stores were opening their doors in a small area, over 100 stores in a 15-mile radius. And some of her constituents didn't like what they were seeing.
And then they just kept continuing to just pop up. And the more we started having the conversation, the more people, the more residents, the more citizens started joining in to the conversation expressing their concerns of these stores that were opening in their community.
They were concerned that stores like Dollar General and Dollar Tree were keeping out full-service grocers like H-E-B and Kroger and forcing residents to travel further to access fresh foods. So the councilwoman led a push to change the city's zoning code to prevent new dollar stores from opening within 2 miles of an existing one. Any new dollar store would also have to devote at least 15% of floor space to fresh foods. The measure passed on an 8-1 vote earlier this month. But the problem of stores like Dollar General or Dollar Tree overcrowding communities isn't limited to Fort Worth.
There are regions or neighborhoods within a lot of major cities where there are dozens or in some cases hundreds of dollar stores. They can be as close together as a block or two apart, sometimes across the street.
That's Stacy Mitchell, co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. They're an advocacy group focusing on community economic development.
By opening at that level of density, they really crowd out the possibility of other local businesses coming in, and particularly local grocery stores being able to have a foothold in the market.
That's because it's more expensive to operate a full-service grocery store. Fresh foods like fruits and vegetables don't have the profit margins that processed food items do. And when dollar stores have already cornered the market in these areas on those profitable processed goods, opening a new grocery store in the area becomes a risky undertaking.
That's the, you know, they basically skim off like the profitable part of a grocery store, and they don't offer the unprofitable part of the grocery store, which is the fresh food.
So that perpetuates the cycle of food deserts in underserved communities, like in Councilmember Gray's district, where people have to travel longer distances for healthy foods.
My constituents leave the community in order to shop. They are the ones that I see in the grocery store in other parts of the city buying groceries.
But Gray says she's hoping to change that by challenging the idea that low-income communities won't shop at grocery stores. She hopes that by containing the explosion of dollar stores in her district, other stores will see an opportunity.
But it's getting past that perception, and that becomes our big thing. How we get past the perception that communities of color don't have money to shop, because we really and truly do, and we're already doing it.
In the meantime, Gray says the next step is working with existing dollar stores to offer more healthy options. I'm Alexandra Hart for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Right about now, the ads on TV and your social media channels, too, are likely filled with last-minute gift guides. What should you get that hard-to-buy for a friend or family member with just a few days left before zero hour? You know how it goes. Well, surprise! Our tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to suggest a few heavily advertised gifts you might want to avoid this holiday season, and why. Hey there, Omar. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, David.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch.
This year.
Why do this so close to Christmas, an anti-gift guide?
You know, tech gifts are easy. I mean, you see them advertised. They're on sale. Amazon, in particular, is very aggressive around this time of getting you to buy a $19 tech gadget for someone.
Yeah,
and that's very attractive, the pricing. And oh, I'll just get them that. And I don't think we put a lot of thought into, okay, what are we actually getting that person into when we give some of these tech gifts? So I've taken a step back this year from recommending some products that in the past we have recommended hardly.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I don't want you to spoil things, because someone I know is going to love this cube-shaped alarm clock that charges your phone that I got them
on
Amazon.
Oh, is that me? Did you give me that?
Yeah.
Is that my gift?
Let's talk about some of these gizmos and some of this tech in quotation marks. What sort of gizmos are we talking about, actually?
Well, I mean, one thing is compatibility. You wouldn't give an Apple Watch to someone who uses an Android phone, for instance. I mean, that's a device that works best with an iPhone. So you got to think about, what do they already have? Is this a device, if you're giving them a tech gift, is it something that's going to work with what they already have? And are you kind of pushing them into an ecosystem that they're not in? Are they not a Google user or an Amazon user? Mm-hmm. You got to give a little bit of thought to, what does this gift tie them into?
That's a fair point. And I think a lot of times you're looking for that last minute gift, and you lose track of that. You also caution against buying family or friends a smartphone. And I have to say,
That, to me, seems like a pretty great gift to give someone, no?
It would be if the person, you know, A, needs a new phone and wants a new phone. If they don't, it can be a lot of headaches. You know, if you've had to switch over to a new phone before you're ready, you know that that can be a real hassle just transferring your data and getting it all set up and getting a new case for it. You're tying someone into something they may not be ready for. And also, I mean, it's a very personal device. I think smartphones are probably the most personal device we use every day. And if you get the person the wrong one, you know, the one that they don't want, you're really, again, saddling them with something that maybe it's not the phone they would have bought for themselves.
And then, of course, there are some of these tech gadgets that present automatic privacy or security issues that people might not be aware of.
Yes.
You know, it used to be that the Ring doorbell was the hot thing, right? But now there's some question marks.
I think around this year, last time, we may have recommended some of these devices, some of the Amazon Alexa devices that were getting better and better. This year has really been kind of a watershed, especially, you know, for me and other tech writers have seen how these tech companies are actually using this data, some of these security breaches that we're seeing, particularly with the Ring doorbells recently, and just, you know, can we really trust these tech companies to not use this audio for some of these voice-activated devices and transcribe them or share that information or use it somehow? There have been a lot of questions this year, and it's making me very leery of recommending things like the Amazon Alexa devices, the Google Home devices, Facebook's portal, all of these devices that are supposed to make your life easier and help you communicate and connect with people. I'm taking a step back from recommending them. I think you need to really think about it before you give that to someone and introduce that into their life and their home.
Yeah, I know there have been some high profile stories of some of these cameras getting hacked. Well, what about a couple of good tech gift ideas in the final seconds here? You can't be all negative.
Yeah, it's not all bad. There's a few devices that I really like this year. One, I hesitated a long time to get a Tile device. I don't know if you know what these are.
Love my Tile devices.
I love mine. I got one as a gift recently, and I'd never used one, and I was like, this is amazing. I'm always losing my stuff. I'm always losing my bag. And these are Bluetooth-enabled trackers that can help you, that you can stick onto things or tie them to things, help you keep from losing things like your work bag or your remote control or what have you. iPads are a good upgrade right now. They've gotten very inexpensive.
iPads, Tile devices. Omar Gallaga. He's making his list and checking it twice over at TechMinuteTexas.com.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A federal judge in Texas will decide how much of the Affordable Care Act is still legal. That's after an appeals court ruling that the ACA's penalty for not having health insurance is unconstitutional. A three-judge panel in New Orleans issued the decision Wednesday in response to a case led by Texas to overturn the Obama-era law. The case now returns to the Fort Worth judge who initially deemed the entire ACA invalid after Congress removed the law's so-called individual mandate in 2017. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality says a serial polluter in the Port Arthur area could face higher fines than initially proposed. KUT's Mose Bouchel reports the unusual decision, followed testimony from residents near the chemical plant.
The fines were for air pollution violations at the TPC chemical plant a year ago. But since then, explosions at the plant forced the evacuation of people in neighboring communities. Fred Vernon was one of them. He told the commission his family was cooking Thanksgiving dinner when the explosions came.
I remember grabbing my baby girl and putting a blanket over her head, and she began to throw up as we brought her outside. Myself, I began to vomit as I'm getting her strapped into the car seat. My wife getting the items that she could from the house as we, you know, we left all the yams and turkey that we were cooking. We just abandoned that and left that in the house.
TCEQ commissioners voted to send the penalty decision against TPC to the state attorney general, leaving open the possibility of higher fines, something public health advocates say is extremely rare. The vote comes after reports of increased air pollution and lackluster air quality monitoring in the Gulf Coast region from both the EPA Inspector General and Texas environmental groups. I'm Mose Bouchel in Austin.
For the second time in a row, former San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro will not be among the Democratic presidential hopefuls taking the stage for a debate tonight. Castro's campaign failed again to meet the polling requirements to qualify for the event in Los Angeles. Political science professor Sharon Navarro with the University of Texas at San Antonio says Castro is missing another crucial opportunity to raise his profile among party supporters.
These are the ones that are going to go out and mobilize for you, campaign. If they don't know you exist, if they can't see you, then you're pretty much non-existent. So it's increasingly important that he get this type of visibility in comparison to other candidates.
Castro and other candidates recently called on the Democratic National Committee to relax debate qualifications for the next debate in January. And a federal judge has dismissed the Houston Independent School District's lawsuit asking to stop a Texas education agency from taking it over. The decision Wednesday found HISD's complaint lacked standing. I'm Joseph Leahy from the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. There's been a lot of conversation this year about whether or not social media platforms should do more to police themselves. Stop and think about this for just a moment. How do you think Google and Facebook keep images of graphic violence and sexual crimes off their platforms? Well, they actually, like other tech giants, employ content moderators who spend their days sifting through posts containing things like shootings, beheadings, child abuse, and a whole lot more awful stuff. And they're trying to remove the worst of what they come across. But as you might imagine, this work takes a heavy toll on those who do it, including YouTube moderators who work right here in the Texas capital city. Casey Newton is the Silicon Valley editor for The Verge, where he's been writing about social media companies employing contractors to flag violent and extreme content on their sites. Casey, welcome to the Texas Standard.
It's great to be here, David.
Earlier this year, you wrote about some contractors working for a company called Cognizant. Facebook hires them to moderate violent content and the impact it has on folks who spend hours viewing this material. This time, you focused on another contractor somewhat closer to our home. Is that correct?
That's right. I wrote about a site that is in Austin that is run by the company Accenture. And so I got to spend a good amount of time in Austin this year meeting the folks who work at that site.
What was it that those employees were looking for? And just to be clear, they're employees of Accenture and not Google, right?
That's right. Although the boundaries get blurry, you know, everyone who works at that site gets a Google.com email address, and these jobs only exist because Google, you know, hired Accenture to hire these people for them. But the folks that I spoke with just had a lot of concerns about the long-term impact of doing the work that they're doing. I spoke to a group who works on what they call the VEQ, VE standing for violent extremism. And every day they have to watch 120 videos over 5 hours that are suspected of containing graphic violence. And many of them, as you might imagine, are starting to experience mental health problems as a result.
Back up for just a minute. When they are working on this VE team, are they working together, say, in a single room, or are they doing this on their own in their own, you know, apartments and that kind of thing? How would you describe that workplace setting?
So it's built like a call center, and it's essentially shift work. So these folks show up for their shift. They have to put all of their personal belongings into lockers. They're not allowed to bring their phones or anything onto what they call the production floor. They sit down at a workstation, and they log on. They put on their headphones, and then they just start looking at violent content for 5 hours.
Is there uniformity when it comes to how they describe what it is that they do? I mean, in other words, do some people say, you know, it's not a great job, but I like it good enough. I mean, it pays well enough, that kind of thing. Or do you hear something sort of more uniformly about the conditions of having to, you know, watch these videos?
I have talked to people who say exactly what you just said. You know, not the greatest job in the world, but I get by.
at the same time, I have talked to an increasing number of people who are very worried about how the job changed their personality. I've talked with people who have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. One thing that I have found is that when you're doing this work, you never know when it is going to be the moment that you see the thing that you can't unsee, right? You never know what is going to be the thing that haunts you forever until it's too late. And I think that is one of the sort of core challenges, you know, as human beings, most of us are sensitive souls at some level. And so there's just, I think in many, many cases, going to be a moment where folks see something and it starts to create a lot of problems for them.
You know, I was just thinking about what sort of workplace protections exist for workers in this sort of situation, because this does seem to be extraordinary and you're exposed to a kind of violence that seems to be rare in the workplace.
Yeah, you know, an analogy I sometimes like to use is police officers, right? In a lot of ways, these folks are police officers of the internet. But, you know, you think about maybe you're a homicide detective. Most days, let's assume you're not going to see more than one crime scene a day, right? But if you're a content moderator, you are effectively teleporting between 120 crime scenes a day, right? And so in a way, you're actually seeing radically more violence and disturbing things than even a police officer does. But, you know, unlike police officers, who we all pay for through our tax dollars and who we give pensions, these folks tend to be paid on the low end of the scale, you know, making money that is similar to what a janitor might make, for example. So there's just kind of a real inequality there that I'm hoping more folks start to pay attention to.
Casey Newton reports on Silicon Valley for The Verge. We'll have a link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Casey, this is fascinating. Thanks so much, so very much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
I really appreciate you having me on.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at texasoncology.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Marika Flatt, travel editor with Texas Lifestyle Magazine, here with your weekend trip tip. Although the Alamo is the most famous, San Antonio has several other must-see old Spanish missions that are surrounded by mystery and intrigue. The four missions of the National Park Service Mission Trail are highlights of a historic tour of the city. And today, they are UNESCO World Heritage Sites. All are nearly 300 years old or more and were once the center of Spanish governance of the San Antonio region. Today, under an agreement with the Archdiocese, all the missions remain active churches. The missions are located along the San Antonio River, south of downtown. The trail is officially designated the El Camino Real de los Tejas National Historic Trail. Take St. Mary's Street south of the city, and it will turn into Roosevelt Avenue. Several miles later, on your right, Mission Road leads you to the first complex, Mission Concepcion. This mission was established in 1731. Spanish Catholic missionaries worked here with Native Americans to convert them to Christianity. In addition to being in the national park, the mission is also listed on the National Historic Landmark Register. Some historians consider it Stone Church the oldest unrestored church in America. The next stop heading south is Mission San Jose. With a stone-walled perimeter, this is the largest mission in the national park. Mission San Jose served as a defensive village for Spanish and Native American residents. The walls were for protection from frequent Comanche and Apache raids, and much of the mission was restored in the 1930s by the WPA program during the Great Depression. And it's also where you'll find the park's visitor center. The third mission along the trail is Mission San Juan. It has a watering system that is over 300 years old. It provided residents with drinking water and was a source of irrigation for their gardens. Some of the mission property is still set aside for farming, and the San Antonio Food Bank plants and harvests crops here. The final stop is Mission Espada. It was the first Spanish mission in Texas, founded in 1690, Much of the mission is built of adobe brick compared to the stonework in other locations. The mission trail runs about 8 miles and can be driven, hiked, or biked, although traffic can be an issue on Roosevelt Avenue. San Antonio's Viva Bus Tour number 40 takes you to all the missions and runs every half hour. The fare is $2.75 and exact change is needed. Plan to spend at least a half a day on the trail and consider the ranger-led tour at Mission San Jose. Admission to the national park is free, and there's plenty of free parking at all the missions. That's your weekend trip tip. I'm Marika Flatt for the Texas Standard.
Marika Flatt is travel editor for Texas Lifestyle Magazine. You can find more of her weekend trip tips at texasstandard.org. So the countdown on, and still the tree undecorated and that to-do list dragging on the floor. You think you got it tough. Try taking thousands of Dallas school kids on the annual holiday field trip, as KERA's Bill Zeeble discovered. Making that one work is a bit of extended choreography that might humble even the busiest of us.
It's about 10 o'clock on a Friday morning, and 2,206 Dallas ISD third graders are filling the Winspear Opera House to capacity. For most of these 8 and 9-year-olds, it's their first visit. Their eyes pop wide, impressed as jaws drop, and they're only in the lobby. Students are single filing in to watch the children's classic Peter and the Wolf. Today, Prokofiev's tale is performed by the Texas Ballet Theater. There's the cat, a duck, the wolf, and Peter. The students love it. While this short performance is why they came, getting to this point actually began hours ago.
All right, hey everybody, how's everyone doing this morning?
Anastasia Farr is the senior house manager for the AT&T Performing Arts Center. She's worked every one of these student matinees without fail for 10 years. This is the 9 a.m. briefing in the Winspear lobby.
Oh, y'all, it's Friday. Yay! It's been a bit of a long week.
This week's job for Farr's 30 volunteers is to get the kids safely in their seats. It all starts by getting them off nearly 60 buses arriving about now. A bus pulls up. Volunteer Stuart Jacobs hops on and hands the teacher a number so she can find the right bus when it's time to leave.
Hey guys, you're going to be bus number 2.
Okay.
We're going to get you off the bus into the show. You're here to see Peter and the Wolf's great performance. So everything stays on the bus except for you guys. We're going to take you on inside. You get to see a great show. Okay? Here we go.
Volunteers have color-coded seating charts for every one of the kids from every one of the 24 schools in the house today. Kids like 8-year-old Sarah Stanford from Dallas's Reinhardt Elementary.
Wow, I think this place is awesome. Because, well, this is the Dallas Opera House, and it's really famous. I'm really happy to be here.
The performance makes everyone happy, too. But after, the already loud cheers and squeals explode when the Winspear's electronic chandelier of 318 light rods descends from the ceiling. For kids like Arlette Reyes, the light show is an unforgettable thrill.
It was pretty cool because it went down and it stopped and then it kept going down and stopping. And I liked how it has colors and lights.
And the dancers in the story were the highlight for Kayla Harris.
I like the show because, like, they had music and they had, like, the costumes and they had, like, the actress actually trying to actually playing the part, and I recommend it.
Volunteer usher Ruth Hunter Hill recommends spending more time around kids like these third graders.
I think kids just have an excitement that we as adults have forgotten. When I said, "Welcome to the Winspear Opera House," oh my gosh, opera, opera. This is my first time, and they were hugging me, just happy to be here. We forget what a joy it is just to be alive. The kids kind of remind us of that.
These kids and teachers are then reminded it's time to go. Remember how the teachers each got a number for the bus? Those numbers now get called from the stage as their buses line up outside.
Bus number 14. 14.
Then it's single file and back out the door. Robert McDowell, who helped the kids get in, now bids them farewell.
Okay, bus 46, y'all ready?
Yep.
You're gonna go straight out to the street.
Okay.
Thank you.
Y'all have a great weekend. Happy holidays. Bye, guys.
The kids saw a performance that lasted 40 minutes. It gave them memories that may last a lifetime. I'm Bill Zeebel in Dallas.
And about 5 years ago, the town of Marshall out in East Texas ended its seventh grade tackle football program. There's a lot of concerns about how safe the game was for children. Well, this past spring, the Marshall Independent School District voted to unanimously reinstate the program. And you know what? A lot of residents are mighty happy about that change. We hope you can join us tomorrow as we dig deeper into the hows and whys and what's in Marshall, Texas. That's tomorrow on The Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. 'Tis the time we in the news business take stock of the year that was, right? And in Texas, no such account can be complete without referencing a certain Texas institution known as the Bum Steer Awards. Yes, these, of course, are the annual prizes handed out by Texas Monthly Magazine to the Texan or Texans who stepped into it the deepest, so to speak. This year, the honor goes to two beleaguered Texas politicos. Let's let Jeff Salomon do the on-air honors here. He is deputy editor of Texas Monthly and editor of this year's presentation. Jeff, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Glad to be here, David.
Now, I know this is no secret. It's out on social media already. But just for jollies, the envelope is yours now. Who are the two winners of this year's Bum Steer Awards?
The winners, or losers, depending on how you want to look at it, are Beto O'Rourke and Dennis Bonin. Beto O'Rourke, of course, was famously the Democratic senatorial candidate who ran against Ted Cruz in 2018 and narrowly lost, and then decided to run for president, which wound up being a fairly ill-fated venture.
And Dennis Bonin is the former Speaker of the House.
I believe he is technically still the Speaker of the House.
There you go. All right.
But he has declared that he will not run for re-election. And, you know, journalists try not to be particularly judgmental, but I think it's pretty okay to refer to him as the disgraced Speaker of the House. I don't think I've ever seen a political scandal like that in this state. I don't think there is anybody who supports what Bonin did.
We should do a little bit of background here, because what I find fascinating is that it wasn't that long ago, as I recall, Texas Monthly itself was sort of celebrating Dennis Bonin as one of the big winners in the Texas legislative session, right?
That's right. Last summer, in our biannual Best and Worst Legislators list, we named him one of the best legislators, and we were hardly alone.
So what exactly happened here?
Boy, this is a complicated story. Bonin agreed to meet with a man named Michael Quinn Sullivan, who is a noted conservative activist. And during the meeting, basically, Bonin offered to Quinn Sullivan that he would give Sullivan's organization, Empower Texans, floor passes to the legislature so they could cover it as if they were members
of... Like media passes,
media basically. Passes, that's correct. So they could cover it as members of the press. But essentially, in exchange, he asked Quinn Sullivan to go after a number of other legislators during the next election, including some of Bonin's fellow Republicans, people he had promised to protect and not, you know, work against, even if he had his differences with them. And sometime a few weeks after that meeting, Sullivan, on his website and then on Twitter, basically said what had happened at that meeting, and then revealed that he had taped the entire meeting.
But what about Beto O'Rourke? What explains him sharing the mud with Bonin?
You know, our feeling is, first of all, we wouldn't name someone a bum steer simply for trying and failing at something. You know, that's a very human thing. You try something, you fail. We're not going to mock somebody for that. The feeling was that he squandered a great deal of political capital and popularity in Texas. And instead of trying to spend that capital in Texas and help Texas, where Texas Democrats, you know, really needed him, he went off on a national run for a position that
arguably he really was not in a, he was really not terribly well qualified for. He did not seem to have a campaign that had a very clear focus. And a large number of people, large number of Texas Democrats really pled with him not to make that run. I mean, I think, you know, Beto's failing, and if one agrees that it was a failing, I think was a very human failing. You know, he was lifted up so high. A lot of people were telling him, you can do anything, the sky's the limit. And he believed those people and he went for something big. And I think, you know, he reached for more than he really could grasp. Or do I have that idiom in his door? Is it grasp for more than you can reach?
We get where you're going.
You get
with
where
that.
I'm going.
Yeah, sure. So I have to ask, I mean, if you were to lift the curtain and let us peek, were there any other close contenders here?
Beto and Bonin were definitely the top two. There was some discussion on whether or not Julian Castro belonged there because great potential, you know, for the race, and he's not done particularly well. But the feeling was, first of all, he's not out of the race yet,
right,
so we don't
right.
know where that goes. And B, people felt like he's actually run a fairly honorable race. You know, he's really been out front articulating a lot of progressive positions in a very solid way.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't quite see the material there.
This is a fun read, and if you haven't seen it on newsstands yet, look for it. It's a latest edition of Texas Monthly Magazine, and you'll see Beto O'Rourke and Dennis Bonin right there on the cover. Jeff Salomon is deputy editor of Texas Monthly Magazine. They are the ones who put together the annual Bum Steer Awards. Jeff, good to see you. Thanks so much for stopping by the studio.
Thanks for having me, David.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Okay, Thursday. It's already here.
Thursday feelings afoot.
We've had an impeachment vote.
We've been through a lot. This has been one heck of
like
a month
been
a, this
seems
week.
Seems like it's been a, yeah, I like the way you put that. So what are Texans telling us is on making news where they are?
Well, I'll tell you what, those 2020 bum steer picks from Texas Monthly sure prompting a lot of talk.
I bet they are.
Especially on Twitter, where the Beto O'Rourke support can run pretty thick at times.
Yeah.
Yeah, Beto Twitter not having it. Via Twitter, Melissa Palomo Ramon writes, it's trashy to dump on O'Rourke, who's the hardest working and most effective Democrat in Texas. She writes that Texas Monthly totally discounted his steadfast support for border communities, shows that they don't know Texas. And Andrew Lopez compares and contrasts the two cover stars, if you will, of this year's Bum Steers Awards. Andrew writes, Bonin stabbed his own state house members in the back by meeting with a lobbyist to primary them while making sexist and homophobic insults. O'Rourke lost a Senate race and dropped out of a presidential primary. One of these things is not like the other. So obviously, yes, lots more contention there. And, you know, the whole thing is online right now, probably at newsstands as well. And I encourage you to read, because if those two picks don't get your ire up, I'm sure certain some other stuff will.
Yeah.
So always a fun read, definitely.
Well, it is a fun read, and I like the way that Texas Monthly kind of does it with, you know, a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, but also in the spirit of, hey, we're all Texans here.
Exactly.
And so it's not, I don't find that it's very mean-spirited,
no.
Which is nice.
Well, you know, David, the force is with us. I'm not talking about a certain blockbuster at a theater near you or in a galaxy far, far away for that matter, but the Space Force, which we talked about earlier this week. At the time we took up the proposal, it hadn't yet been voted on at the Senate. Well, now it has been passed and sent to the president's desk for a signature. So good time to check in with our friends and listeners about their reacts to the Space Force, because this really has generated a whole lot of conversation, mm-hmm. I gotta say. Mm-hmm. On our Facebook page, Jerry Helfand says, I think it's a positive thing. He says, protecting our communication, navigation, scientific, and entertainment infrastructure. Those space-based technologies are a critical part of our GDP and help power new innovations on Earth. Meanwhile, James Avery, I believe, says somewhat ironically, glad to see that we figured out how to make sure all Americans are fed, clothed, housed, educated, and healed, and had enough money left over for things like a Space Force. However, Craig Anders York says, depending on how it's purposed and how it's employed, a Space Force might not be a bad thing, regardless of the incumbent's motives. There are plenty of moribund satellites in orbit, for instance.
So. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's a lot of space junk out there.
Yeah, hear about that.
We were talking about some bad tech gifts for the holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
Bada Eats Dallas says, don't get your significant other a printer, even if they asked. That sounds like a little personal experience.
Really
might be.
Really is the word. Have you ever been satisfied with a home printer? I have not.
Oh, boy. I'm not even going to go there. Hey, listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast. Keep your ideas a-coming to Texas Standard. We'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you will be, too. Till then, I'm David, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.